Wide Area and Resistance. This is the webmaster. September 8th, 2016. Well, I usually just listen to the candidates speaking. This one last night was interesting to watch. I happened to be at work and was able to see it instead of driving. So the symbolism couldn't be missed on that show last night. They had the World Trade Center in the background, behind all the military ships, and the candidates were basically speaking to a military audience and were pretty much asked all military-directed questions. But I did think after Clinton and Trump were done, I did think that the interesting part was when one of the military interviewers was up on stage with Rachel Maddow and the two military generals, and he pointed out sergeants that have done tours in Iraq, and the soldiers that are under the generals knew much more about ISIS and how to take care of ISIS than the generals did. And he casually threw in respectfully at the end of that. Both candidates were like roosters puffed up that they were not going to privatize the VA. Most of their statements had to do with getting the vets care. But the reason they don't want to privatize the VA, and they won't privatize the VA, is because all those records that are classified on what chemicals and vaccines that these guys have been exposed to would have to be put into the files in the private hands of physicians so they could effectively treat them. Without that, they could not effectively treat them.
I've got two interviews on the show tonight. The first one is the history of the Congo and the corporate influence that created the destruction of that country. And the second is about Hillary and her connections and intentions if she becomes president in starting World War III with Russia. And it's interesting that on the day of this debate this morning, there were a couple of U.S. planes without transponders on going into Russian airspace, and they weren't shot down by Russia. Whereas if it would have been the other way around and Hillary or Trump were in charge, I doubt that it would have been the same.
I say it again. Congo is very rich. We have a lot of minerals, but it has never profited to the population. It has caused so many damage, so many sufferings to Congolese people. We don't need it. If some people are interested in our minerals, they can come. But the question is, to come to take the minerals, must they shed blood?
The Democratic Republic of Congo is home to some of the most valuable mineral deposits on Earth. Instead of prosperity, competition over Congo's minerals has worsened poverty, exploitation, and in the past two decades, helped finance the deadliest conflict since World War II. In the early morning hours while attending Mass, the unsuspecting residents of this village were attacked by an armed group financed from minerals in the region. Over 600 people were killed that day. The priest was executed. The nuns were raped and dismembered.
When they took the sisters from the church with the priest, they went to kill the priest in our houses. This is the place they killed them. They raped them before, and afterward they used knives to kill them and to do everything they wanted on them. The fields where people were fleeing in.
The natural resources that Congo has been home to, it's a curse and not a blessing.
In 1890, Joseph Conrad traveled to Congo to pilot a riverboat. He returned home sickened by the evil he witnessed. His catharsis was to pen The Heart of Darkness. The darkness he referenced had nothing to do with Congo or the Congolese, but with the Westerners who, under the employment of Belgian King Leopold, enslaved and brutalized the Congolese in an effort to harvest ivory and rubber. They were successful at building an empire for Leopold and killed an estimated 10 million Congolese, half the population. Conrad called what he witnessed the most vile scramble for loot that ever scarred the face of human consciousness. This statement is still relevant today.
The wind of change blowing through the Belgian Congo, and down comes the Belgian flag in Leopoldville.
In 1960, Congo gained independence. The West, however, was not ready to give up its crown jewel of Africa. Or worse, let it fall into the hands of the Soviets. Leaders from the U.S. and Belgium had Congo's newly elected prime minister, Patrice Lumumba, assassinated. His body was dismembered and disintegrated in acid.
We cut them up into pieces, we burned them, and we also had huge quantities of acid.
In his place, the West anointed the dictator, Mobutu Sese Seko. Mobutu changed the name of the country to Zaire and ruled for the next 30 years, remaining a Western ally.
We had accepted that, okay, he's a but he's our
Mobutu basically treated Congo and its resources like his own personal piggy bank. He stole from the state-owned mining companies, he stole from the customs agency, he stole from anything that made revenue, and he didn't invest it in the country in the way that he needed to. He invested it in his own pet projects.
Claiming Congo's resources as his own, Mobutu Sese Seko established a personal wealth of nearly $4 billion, while leaving Congolese people impoverished and starving. Still today, that poverty remains, despite the fact that the Congolese people live atop trillions in mineral resources.
In order to understand the Congo situations, you have to divide it into two categories.
Southern Congo, the province of Katanga, is home to 80% of the world's cobalt and one of the largest copper belts in the world, both strategic minerals.
And this is where the big, big money is made.
Cobalt is used in manufacturing weapon systems that are important to the U.S. Department of Defense.
Eastern Congo has been called a geological treasure trove, littered with the minerals necessary to sustain today's technological boom. Tungsten, tin, tantalum, gold.
As technology turns towards mobile communication, eventually we will all need to turn to the Congo so long as we continue to live in the ways that we have.
Southern Congo is looted by multinational corporations. Armed groups pillage the East. Some are foreign, some are domestic. The acronyms become confusing, the objectives blurred. But one thing is clear. A dominant source of their financing has come from the minerals in eastern Congo.
Armed groups will tax anything they can tax. It just so happens that the largest resource in the eastern Congo, the most lucrative resource in the eastern Congo, is minerals.
Without having to feed them, without having to pay for their clothing and medical care, all they do is to come and seal off the area, and this land is rich in minerals. Well, they have the weapons I do know.
Rape is a horrific weapon of this war, designed to terrorize and destroy the fabric of a community. Of all the native languages spoken in eastern Congo, before 1996, none of them had a word for rape.
The war began in 1996. This was the beginning of the Congolese tragedy, the real beginning of the Congolese tragedy. When the war started in 1996, it was not because of minerals. The war started in 1996. It was because of the collapse of the Zairean state and the genocide in neighboring Rwanda. But once the war had begun, minerals eventually became to play a key role in financing that war. And then at some point, the minerals became an objective in themselves.
After the Rwandan genocide in 1994, 3 million refugees poured over the border into what was then eastern Zaire, creating what the UN called the worst refugee crisis the world has ever known. Some of those refugees were the same militiamen who carried out the genocide. This posed a great security threat for the newly formed government of Rwanda.
In the case of Rwanda, it was an overriding security issue. You had, you know, 30 or 40,000 militiamen and soldiers, you know, doing military training within a stone's throw of the Rwandan border, saying we're going to go back and finish the job.
The Rwandans told us on more than one occasion that if the international community could not handle this problem, they felt compelled to find solutions. I had suspected that if they were going to take action, it was going to be an overt military movement across the border. But instead, they used a covert or clandestine mechanism to do that. They infiltrated Rwandan troops over there, joined up with some local rebels, and that was Kabila and the AFDL.
In 1996, the Rwandan and Ugandan armies, backing the rebel movement, the AFDL, fronted by Congolese bushman Laurent Désiré Kabila, invaded eastern Congo. The Rwandan and Ugandan objectives were to clear out the refugee camps. Laurent Kabila's objective was to overthrow President Mobutu Sese Seko. Bazima Karaha was the AFDL's foreign minister.
For us Africans, this was the first time we see genocide. That culture had to be eliminated. But there was a second problem. The second problem was that Mobutu was number two dictator in the world. He had to be removed. All what I told him, you go through the door or through the window.
After 30 years, the United States made the decision to abandon their Cold War ally, Mobutu Sese Seko. President Clinton sent an UN ambassador, Bill Richardson, to deliver the message to Mobutu.
And my instructions were from the U.S. government to say to President Mobutu, we can't support you anymore. We want you to leave the country. And I remember Mobutu looking at me and saying, you know how much I've supported the United States. And I said, I understand that.
The United States and much of the world community is increasingly seeing a new breed of African leaders. The dominant vision and narrative was going to be, from that point onward, to support Kabila and to make it happen.
I had several meetings with Kabila, and I knew Kabila liked me. We had a little bit of chemistry. I said to him, well, you want a good relationship with the United States? We want a peaceful resolution. We'd like to be able to help you if you're a reformer, if you practice democracy, if you observe human rights. We'll help you.
Once the Cold War was over, Mobutu was no longer necessary, and the United States allowed Congo to disintegrate.
Although the AFDL moved very quickly, it soon became clear that they would need significant financing to take the capital city, Kinshasa.
Kabila, I recall, said, can you give me a $100 million loan from Clinton? Right then I knew he didn't understand the policy process.
One of the things the AFDL were trying to do was round up money. And in the Congo, one of the ways you do that is through giving out minerals concessions.
In an effort to finance the war, the AFDL headed directly to the copper and cobalt-rich region of Katanga.
It started in the Kivus, but Katanga was then and has always been a key part of the Congolese conflict simply because of this is where the money lies.
The real mineral wealth of the Congo is in Katanga.
This is where the big, big money is made.
Katanga is home to one of the world's largest copper belts and produces over 80% of the world's cobalt, both strategic minerals.
The Department of Defense's Defense Logistics Agency, which has a strategic minerals division, ranks cobalt in the top 10.
So many people came here to make a quick buck during the war, and they did.
While the troops of rebel leader Laurent Kabila now control the mineral-rich areas of the country, giants like American Mining Field Corporation are taking advantage of the shifting political scene to swap their allegiances. Mining deals in cobalt, zinc, copper, and diamonds are being signed with the rebels.
Non, il y en a eu beaucoup. Il y a eu AMFI qui s'est arrivé, il y a le groupe Lundin qui est arrivé, il y a Anvil Mining, ce sont des Australiens qui sont arrivés, et nous avions un groupe canadien qui est arrivé aussi, First Quantum.
On était en guerre, et tous les marchands d'armes en ont profité pour venir prendre des minéraux, mais c'était à vil prix.
So 1996 was a month in Congo.
Executives from American mineral fields are busy currying favor with the new regime in any way they can.
I think the most classic example was Jean-Raymond Boule, who worked for a company called American Mineral Fields. And he flew with his private jet down to Katanga. He actually lent his private jet to Kabila at a certain point and struck a deal nailing down a very important mining concession there.
We have made our plane available to seven members, seven leaders of the alliance.
They gave $5 million to the AFDL before they even arrived in Kinshasa. They gave $5 million to the AFDL, I believe it was in April of 1997, 1 month before they arrived in Kinshasa. They were doing business with a rebel government, where they hadn't even taken over the official government yet.
You know, this is what multinationals do, and you deal with the powers that be, or the powers that you think will be. Just the way it works.
It did not go unnoticed that AMF's headquarters was based in Hope, Arkansas, hometown of then U.S. President Bill Clinton.
The fact that this was a company whose corporate headquarters was listed as Hope, Arkansas, which no one had even heard of in most of the world except in its relation to Bill Clinton, amplified the perception that this was somehow connected to the United States, that this was the United States itself giving its imprimatur to the invasion and to the takeover by Laurent Kabila.
The big conspiracy, the first company that signed a deal with Kabila was American Mineral Fields.
Yeah, and I think that fell through.
Yes, but a significant amount of money did change hands.
No doubt. Because you see, the ADFL were looking for money. They wanted it to buy arms.
The AFDL's attacks were focused on refugees in eastern Congo.
We shall hit badly this camp and kick everybody out without any consideration from the international community.
Did we know that the ADFL were massacring people in camps and so on? We heard about it. We had lots of stories about that. But we also knew there wasn't a darn thing we could do about it. I'm not saying you don't want to, you know, you should accept these things, but you don't want to kid yourself about some of these things. It's a war.
The most painful part for people like myself and for people who were involved in supporting human rights in the Congo for a period of time and of having really been optimistic about the democracy process in the Congo was that the local democracy movement in the Congo was abandoned completely. They didn't include the opposition, the Catholic Church, the other forces that had been so important to and would be so important for building any kind of democratic and accountable society. The United States didn't push for that and didn't do anything to help that happen.
On May 17th, 1997, the ADFL forces overtook Kinshasa. Laurent Désiré Kabila was sworn in as president of the newly named Democratic Republic of Congo.
Moi, Laurent Désiré Kabila, président de la République.
We had our own objective as a Congolese. They had theirs. But as far as I know, they didn't use us. Actually, maybe you can also say that we used them.
Since the 1996 invasion, peace has never returned to eastern Congo, where it is estimated that over 1.5 million people died during the AFDL march. Approximately 400,000 of them died in the camps.
virtually lawless and ungoverned, armed groups plague the once peaceful region.
What I know, starting that time, we could see bodies lying all over the streets, and no one taking care of them. People killing one another just like nothing. So that's when the Congolese mind, especially in the East, became spoiled.
One of the most feared armed groups operating in Eastern Congo was founded by the survivors of the refugee camp massacres and former Rwandan genocidaires. They are known as the FDLR, or the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda.
Crosstalk the Hillary Doctrine. I'm joined by my guest, Harlan Hill in New York. He is a Democratic consultant. In Washington, we have Michael Maloof. He is a senior reporter for the World Net Daily and a former Pentagon official. And in Austin, we cross to Matt Macoviak. He is a Republican strategist. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I very much appreciate it. Michael, if I can go to you, trying to formulate Hillary Clinton's foreign policy isn't easy, at least in my mind here. I mean, is she replicating and moving to the right of George W. Bush? Is she going to be a more aggressive form of Barack Obama? Or is she going to be something all to herself, a unique doctrine of foreign policy to come out if she's elected, if she takes office in January? Go ahead.
Well, you have to understand what the Hillary Doctrine is, and there have been a few books written about it, but it basically, the Hillary Doctrine was the promotion of women's rights, but then she began to equate it with national security. And then subsequent to that, we saw that she began to say, in effect, that regime change will help bring about women's rights and with new governments and more enlightenment, because the whole idea is that with women being in office and being much more part of the political landscape, these countries are going to thrive. Now, that we've seen that she has actually worked with countries that have just the opposite view. And in fact, many of these countries have contributed to her foundation, the Clinton Foundation, and yet she still takes money from them, even though their policies toward women have been back in the medieval times. I think it is a prescription for a much more assertive policy. She has sounded much tougher, and I don't know if she's going to push the women's angle as a basis for national security forays regime change in these other countries. Yeah. But clearly what she's demonstrated and talked about in Syria, as well, yeah, as in the example of Libya, is a little bit disturbing.
Harlan, if I go to you in New York, I mean, we've already heard in this campaign that one of the first things she wants to tackle the first day she's in the White House, if she is inaugurated, she wants to deal with Syria. But it doesn't sound like she wants to emulate the current president of the United States, Barack Obama. She sounds much more aggressive. I mean, is this a campaign slogan for her, or do you really think it? Because, you know, we all know that a number of prominent neocons have moved over to into her camp. So what does that tell you? Go ahead in New York.
Well, without question. I mean, look, Hillary Clinton has supported every war that the United States has entered or desired to enter since Vietnam. She's a Goldwater girl. She is the quintessential neocon that's looking to pick up the mantle of George W. Bush. I foresee that she is a continuation of the W administration. I think that, you know, Barack Obama has been more of a hawk than most Democrats, yeah, have in recent years, certainly more than Bill, yep, Clinton was. And, you know, you look at the drone strikes, which I think are the collateral damage that comes along with those are really detrimental to American foreign policy and how people perceive us abroad. They don't make sense. We're not able to capture and extract intelligence from the sites that we just indiscriminately bomb. It doesn't make sense. And so I foresee that she's both a continuation of that top-down approach that Barack Obama has pursued with drone strikes from the sky, but also boots on the ground, as we saw with the W administration. Those combined, I think, are a recipe for total disaster. We need nation building at home. That's why I'm one of the most vocal Democrats that support Donald Trump. I don't think that he's going to put boots on the ground. I don't think he's going to invade any other countries. I think that he is interested in nation building at home.
Yep.
That's what I saw a lot of appeal in Bernie Sanders' message when he was saying the same thing. And I think Trump will do the same.
Okay, Matt, let me go to you. I mean, this is how Orwellian it's gotten, at least in my mind. And I look at this from a distance, obviously, because I'm actually very far away. But how can it, Hillary Clinton talks about our values. How can we spread our values with military interventions? I've never been able to, you know, put those two together because I listened to her rhetoric and she, number one, we don't cozy up to dictators. What is she talking about? I mean, anyone that follows the news can at least get a little inkling that, well, those guys in Saudi Arabia, they're not really Democrats, are they? And the Clinton Foundation took millions and millions, I think $25 million from them. And she's talking about not cozying up to dictators. I mean, I don't see anyone in the mainstream media saying, by the way, Hillary, no one's doing that. Go ahead.
Yeah, look, I think there's a few points to be made. I think the first is foreign policy is complicated and it's also relative. We treat Saudi Arabia different than we do perhaps, other countries that are not democratic. And that's because of their oil and their power in the region. But I think when you look at Hillary, it's important to compare the way she approached foreign policy when she was United States Senator from New York after she left as First Lady, and then how she served as Secretary of State for 4 years, the first 4 years of the Obama administration. You know, she came in 2001, was obviously deeply affected by 9/11, as all Americans were, but particularly elected officials from the state of New York. And she did support the incursion, the invasion, the attack on Afghanistan to take out the Taliban. And she's been considered a defense hawk as a Democrat ever since then. And that's been an unusual position. In the 50s, 60s, and 70s in the United States, there were defense hawks that were Democrats. They were scoopjacks and Democrats. They almost don't exist anymore in the United States because the Democratic Party's been pulled to the left, just like the Republican Party's been pulled to the right. But if you look at her term as Secretary of State, to me it's a bit confused. And it's because I think she has her own intentions, but she's really been pulled to the left by Obama on some things. She did advocate for the military intervention into Libya, which became a total disaster. She did advocate for the military intervention in Syria, which has been a total disaster. She did propose and carry out the Russian reset, which was naive. And she did lay the groundwork for the Iran deal, the nuclear agreement with Iran, which has basically been a failure so far. So she has some problems. I think she supports the idea of, quote, smart power, which is basically maintaining our defense posture as it is, not ramping it up, but trying to sort of use international institutions as a way to achieve what you might achieve militarily, to work through the UN, to work through NATO, to work through our alliances. And so, you know, there's a little bit of a naivete that comes with that. From my perspective, she is to Obama's right on foreign policy, but I think to the left of the mainstream of the Republican Party.
Okay, Arlen, it's the point of the program. You want to jump in? Go ahead.
Yeah, she's not naive. She doesn't have an overarching ideology that drives her decision making. And I think that's why she looks so confused, because I think that every decision she's made up until now, including her support for the invasion of Iraq, including her decision to communicate classified information on her private email server, to disregard classified markings and to put national security at risk, was all driven by her intent to push her career further.
Exactly.
Her interest is not in the best interest of the United States.
Exactly. Exactly.
That is the truth. She is self-serving.
Okay, Michael, address that, because I think Harlan's absolutely right. She just wants to think that she's going to be on the right side of history, and she keeps falling on the wrong side of history, but she still may be elected president of the United States. This is what's so extraordinary to me. How many people question Libya in the mainstream media? Almost no one does. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I think what you need to look at with Hillary is just who is supporting her. Paul Wolfowitz.
Yep.
Michael
Robert Hagan.
Morrell. Both of them are really very hawkish. Wolfowitz has combined with Richard Perot once again, and they are working toward a much more assertive NATO, for example, to challenge Russia. They represent what that policy is going to be under a Clinton administration should she get in. And I think that regime change, as we saw withdrawal in Iraq, which she supported, is going to be very, very problematic, and we just don't have the internal ability to continue to support another 10 to 15 years of war. And the fact is that these guys are going to be guiding her and giving her that kind of advice, and I think it's very, very dangerous, and I think we have a real problem ahead if we want to work with other countries toward a much more common threat, which is terrorism. She's not going to be working with those people. She's going to be working against them, as we've now seen even Obama in Syria not wanting to work all that much with the Iranians or the Russians on trying to deal with a common enemy.
Okay, well, Matt, you know, let's speak to what Michael said there. I mean, Wolf, it's morale. These people have a career of absolute failure behind them. Their resume has failure written from beginning to end, but they remain very powerful voices in the foreign policy establishment. And Hillary Clinton is very glad to have them on board because, you know, this is, again, where we see no debate in American foreign policy. This is a very tragic time in the public sphere, I think. And no one is questioning, you know, all we need to do is start killing Iranians and Russians. What if a retired Russian general had said that about Americans? That would have been deemed a declaration of war. But no, it's so exceptional, you can't see the immorality of it. Go ahead, Matt, in Austin.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is, look, Hillary has made a direct appeal to both independents and to Republicans. You know, if you look at the first half of her convention speech in Philadelphia, it was one that was, I think, very moderate, very patriotic. She did get into sort of a Democratic laundry list in the second half. If you look at her speech just last week at the American Legion, at the American Legion in Cincinnati, she talked about, yes, American exceptionalism, which is something Democrats very rarely talk about. And there wasn't a lot of policy specifics in the speech, but it was one that had a tone that I think that it did appeal to Republicans. I think for Wolfowitz and Richard Perle and Robert Kagan, and as you say, the neocons, I think they're looking at Hillary and they think she's someone they can at least meet with and be heard from. Trump is someone who they don't believe
has the
qualifications and the temperament to be commander-in-chief.
It's that magical 13-minute moment. I got to jump in, gentlemen. I have to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Hillary Clinton's foreign policy agenda. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Hillary Clinton's foreign policy views. Okay, Harlan, I'd like to go back to New York. You wanted to jump in. I knew when I started talking about American exceptionalism, it would start a lot of sparks here. Go right ahead, my friend, in New York.
Well, I have to say, I don't think that Hillary Clinton is a reflection of patriotism or American exceptionalism. Rather, I think that what she has, I think, both in her policy and in her rhetoric up until this cycle, you know, she has apologized for America left and right. I think that, you know, as Secretary of State, she conducted an apology tour in coordination with Barack Obama that I think was, quite frankly, very embarrassing. Just because now she has changed her tune and she's trying to act as if she's been some arbiter of what it is to be an American and to be patriotic, I find to be very offensive. Rather, I mean, when you look at her policy in the Middle East, she's allowed threats to the very existence of the United States to metastasize. I'm looking particularly at ISIS. That threat is particularly alarming. It's just a matter of time before they're on American shores. They've already killed Americans abroad. And so Hillary Clinton has made the problem worse for Americans through her reckless policy. I don't think that that is at all a reflection of her patriotism or, you know, as the standard bearer of American exceptionalism.
Well, I have to agree with Harlan. If I can go to Michael, I really find it insulting when other people question the patriotism of others. I find those people to be complete scoundrels here. But let me ask you a question, Michael. You know, we're all Americans right here, and we're talking about a presidential campaign. And we all know that there's a layer of the campaign rhetoric, and then there's the policy. And they're not always exactly the same. This is called politicking. But you know what, Michael? On the outside world watching in, these look like fighting words, okay? Really serious fighting words. And people actually do listen outside of the echo chamber that is called the U.S. media. And I worry about that. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, I think that we're already seeing that. She's already expressed concerns and fears about Donald Trump wanting to even talk to Vladimir Putin are wanting to even negotiate a better treaty with the Iranians. In other words, any kind of exchange she's against. She's also pushing for that continued no-flight zone over Syria, which will bring an immediate confrontation. She does not know how to come up with a policy that is consistent with her values and U.S. values, because she has continued to receive the support of some of these major countries that are of concern to us, particularly Saudi Arabia. I go back to what the original definition of the Hillary Doctrine is, and that was her pushing for women's rights and doing this and equating that with a national security priority, and to push that to go into these countries, seek regime change. And with the people who are now surrounding her, I think it's very, very scary what this portends. We've been through 15 years of hell, as far as I'm concerned, on the international scene, which has driven this country into near financial ruin, not to mention morale, with a crumbling infrastructure. And that's all she can talk about in terms of foreign policy. I know we can do better. And I think that we need to be working more closely with other countries. And she's not exhibiting that. She's not exhibiting that at all, particularly countries that have a system other than our own, but she wants to change it.
Harlan, jump in. Go ahead.
Say again?
Go ahead. Let Harlan answer the question. Go ahead, Harlan.
We're four smart guys. We're four smart guys here. And can we point to a single foreign policy accomplishment of the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton?
I can't think of a single accomplishment. I can't.
Not at all.
Okay, Matt, can you?
And I think that's one of the problems.
All right. Let me go to Matt. Can you think of one accomplishment on her resume in foreign policy? Go ahead.
The short answer is no. And the reason this is so important is that this is the single most important credential that she has when she's running for president, is that she was Secretary of State for 4 years. And so I think if you ask the Clinton campaign what are their achievements, they do have a list. It's a short list. It's not impressive. She did, I think, at one time negotiate a ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. I don't remember it. And if it happened, it didn't last very long. So I agree with you. Her record, I think, is very troubling from the 4 years she was Secretary of State, from not continuing the status of forces agreement in Iraq, which gave the opportunity for ISIS to rise, by advocating for the military intervention in Libya and Syria, both of which were a failure. Libya is now a failed state, similar to something like you might see in Somalia. From the nuclear deal with Iran, which has been a failure. Look, there's a lot there. Even China, the pivot to Asia, you now see China taking aggressive actions in the South China Sea, and that's because of the so-called pivot to Asia. So she's had a problem reconciling, you know, maybe her vision of foreign policy and so-called smart power with the reality of a rapidly changing world and metastasizing threats around the globe. I'll just say this as it relates to sort of regime change. The Democratic Party is not going to be with her if she's president of the United States pushing regime change. The only country where I could see that happening in the next 2 to 4 years would be Syria. And that would only be if you could negotiate, civil war.
But would you want
Assad leaving Syria?
Would you want that to be done under international law? Because interventions by the United States have been illegal under international law. That's one of the problems. That's one of the reasons why they end up being disasters. Okay. So, I mean, when Hillary Clinton talks about Syria, and I know American television never talks about the legality or illegality of foreign wars, but that is the basis of the problems that ties, to use your word, over and over again. Michael, I want to ask you an important question here, because I see around the Clinton campaign an element of McCarthyism, of saying anything different. Your credentials are challenged. Your patriotism is challenged. And I find that very frightful going on right now. I know a lot of very important, very smart people in foreign policy establishments. And, you know, they're being cowed, too, because of the kind of McCarthyite attacks that if you say this, that means this, and you're a puppet, and you're paid for, and they're shut out of the public sphere. I mean, if you look at the people talking about foreign policy around the world on CNN and on BBC, they're all the same losers that got us into that illegal war in 2003. There's no downside for saying the wrong thing. There's a lot of downside to say the right thing. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, we've seen that too when just with Trump wanting to express the thought that, yeah, I can talk to this man, I can work with him on things. All of a sudden, Trump is a puppet of Putin. I mean, this is the kind of equating that she does in order to develop these enemies. We've got to have a bad guy. We have to have a boogeyman out there. I might also add, she's also very supportive of the Muslim Brotherhood. She's in terms of Egypt and these countries that are very, very important for that region. She has been a stalwart in support of the Muslim Brotherhood. And this is something that just helps to continue the agitation of jihadi Salafism throughout the region, in addition to the Saudis. I can't get over how she doesn't criticize the Saudis. And yet anybody who wants to meet halfway another country is considered to be a traitor, basically.
Yeah. Well, you don't bite the hand that feeds you. That's what I would say to Hillary Clinton. Okay, I'm in complete agreement with you there, Michael. You know, Harlan, you know, Russia has been introduced into this discussion here. Over the past few days, the sitting president, Barack Obama, sat down with Vladimir Putin for 90 minutes. From what we know, they talk primarily about Syria, as they should, a little bit about Ukraine and probably other issues. But then we have a Democratic nominee that equates Vladimir Putin with Adolf Hitler. So how does Hillary Clinton, as president of the United States, sit down and negotiate important global issues with a man she calls Adolf Hitler?
Well, that's just a ridiculous over-the-top statement that can't be substantiated with facts. And so I'm going to leave that to her surrogates to defend. But the point stands is that they have tried to make Vladimir Putin, who I can say that a lot of people can find fault with him. That's fine.
That's fine.
But they tried to make him the boogeyman throughout this campaign and draw him into the U.S. election. And they did that with the email scandal. For instance, when WikiLeaks released all of the emails out of the DNC, who did they immediately go to? They said, oh, the Russians did it because they're trying to influence the election. You know, and so time and time again, it seems like that's a convenient scapegoat to obfuscate the conversation so that we're not having a conversation about the substance, but rather about who the potential actors are, what are, Russia's hidden motives. Now, and that forgets the fact that there's zero evidence to prove that the Russians had anything to do with the email leak. But regardless, the Hillary campaign was able to successfully change the topic of conversation here in the U.S. media away from the content of the email to what were the Russians doing, what are their motives,
Harlan, but whose fault is that? I think I'm glad you brought that up. But isn't that the fault of the media, not just the Clinton campaign? It's the media that follows it. They follow the lead here. That's why I find the media in the United States to be so irresponsible. I would like to know what was going on more inside those emails. Hacking is something that it happens all of the time, and it's easy to scapegoat someone. But what about the content of it? The media abrogated responsibility on that issue there, and they continue to time and again. Harlan, do you want to really respond to that real quickly?
Without question. And the reason the media was able to do it was because the FBI said that they were looking into the potential of Russians being part of the hack. But there's, once again, zero evidence to substantiate that claim. So I can't entirely blame the media on its own.
Okay, Matt, if I can go to you, 20 seconds. All right, Matt, Michael, go ahead, jump in, 20 seconds, go ahead.
Yeah, you got to consider that this media, this mainstream media, is very supportive of Hillary.
Yep.
And we've seen that time and again where they will not carry critical stories of her. They want her to win. That's why they're not going to carry anything critical of her.
Okay, gentlemen, we've run out of time. Fascinating discussion. Many thanks to my guests in New York, Washington, and in Austin. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.